You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to an author debriefing from the International Spy Museum. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Here at the Spy Museum, we get the world's most interesting authors, including journalists, scholars, former spies and intelligence officers, coming in to answer questions about their latest works dealing with espionage, intelligence, and other national security issues. Please join me in listening to another of our selected author debriefings. We are joined today by Doug Waller, who is a veteran correspondent, author, and lecturer. In almost two decades as a Washington journalist, he covered the Pentagon, Congress, the State Department, the White House, and the CIA. From 1994 to 2007, Waller served in Time Magazine's Washington Bureau, first as a correspondent and then as a senior correspondent. At Time, Doug covered foreign affairs extensively as a diplomatic correspondent, traveling through Europe, Asia, and the Middle East, as well as in the Persian Gulf region. He has reported extensively in the past on Middle East peace negotiations and the wars in Iraq. He came to Time in 1994 from Newsweek, where he reported on major military conflicts from the Gulf War to Somalia to Haiti. And before joining Newsweek in 1988, he served as a legislative assistant on the staffs of a U.S. senator and a representative. He is the author of 9 books, most notably the New York Times bestseller Wild Bill Donovan, the spymaster who created the OSS, and Modern American Espionage, which is coming out in 2011. And the bestsellers, The Commandos, The Inside Story of America's Secret Soldiers from 1994, and Big Red, The 3-Month Voyage of a Trident Nuclear Submarine in 2001. His newest book is Disciples, The World War II Missions of the CIA Directors Who Fought for Wild Bill Donovan. And of course, these disciples are Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, William Colby, and William Casey. Welcome, Doug. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us at the International Spy Museum.
Oh, it's good to be here.
So I usually ask two questions of all of our authors. The first is, what was your inspiration for this book? And I think it seems somewhat clear in this case that based on your last book on Donovan, this was a natural sequel to what came before it.
Well, it was. Although after I finished the Donovan biography, I really had to figure out what I wanted to do next. I mean, by way of background, Donovan was really a larger-than-life figure. You're talking about a hero in World War I who won the Medal of Honor for heroism on the battlefield, a millionaire Republican lawyer who had been often mentioned as a presidential candidate, and the man Franklin Roosevelt picked to be his spy master in World War II. He was also a controversial character. His agents in the field revered him. His political enemies in Washington, and he had a lot of them, thought he was as big a threat to America as Adolf Hitler was. So he's going to be a hard act to follow. And I really hunted around for the next subject. Finally, an archivist at the National Archives, who I'd worked with very closely on the Donovan biography, suggested, why don't you do a book on the three men who served under Donovan in the OSS and who later became CIA directors, which, as you say, was Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, William Colby, and William Casey. And I thought, wow, that's a terrific idea. Why didn't I think of that? So that was the next subject for the next book. These four men served under Donovan during World War II.
It's amazing sometimes that inspiration for books comes from some of the most random places. Hmm. You hinted a little bit at sources. Obviously, you spent time in the National Archives. Can you talk a little bit about your source material for this book?
The good news is that all the OSS records are declassified at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. The bad news is that all the records are declassified at National Archives at College Park, Maryland, because there are millions of pages of documents there. Because of the declassification procedures the CIA had for declassifying the OSS documents, they didn't all come out at the same time. They came out bits and pieces. One paper from this file would be declassified. Another one would stay classified for a while. Then it would get made public, and the two wouldn't be matched. So what you have at the National Archive, through no fault of the archivist there, is a bowl of spaghetti in terms of different files and everything. It took me 3 months just to learn how to wend my way through the OSS records there with the help of a number of archivists. Now, that's one place. For this ensemble biography and for my Donovan biography, too, I went to archives and libraries all over the U.S. where other records were scattered. For example, Alan Dulles's records are at Princeton University at their manuscript archive up there. So are Bill Colby's records. Richard Helms's records are at Georgetown University. William Casey's records are at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. In addition to going around the United States and collecting a lot of that material, I also went to England too. To the National Archives at Kew in London, which housed the British Special Operations Executive records and also some of the MI6, the British Secret Intelligence Service records that have been declassified. The families of the four subjects cooperated with me, provided me a lot of information from their own personal files. Disparate places like Columbia University has an oral history project where people go and give their oral histories there. And there were scores of oral histories there dealing with particularly Alan Dulles and a couple of my other subjects. So, and it all told, it took 3.5 years to research and write this book.
Talking about the archives at College Park are conjuring up bad memories. The OSS document. You're exactly right. It's a mess. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time to figure out how to work your way through those. We want to jump right into your book, but while I have you here and talking about Donovan, since you are the author of Wild Bill Donovan, I think there's two interesting things about Donovan I want to throw towards you. One is he and FDR could not have been more opposite on almost every single issue. Except for they agreed almost completely of the need to have a strong foreign policy and a centralized intelligence agency. It's very similar to of people talk about Lincoln and the Team of Rivals. But this is like modern day if Hillary Clinton brought on Donald Trump or somebody from the far right to be part, maybe not Trump, but Donovan was a war hero and everybody else, right. But brought on somebody like polar opposite to be the CIA chief today. And the second thing I found interesting, you can talk about both these together, about Donovan, was how little he was respected by the other intelligence chiefs, by the head of G2, General Strong, by the head of ONI. And there's an anecdote where it almost took a year before another general officer actually met with Donovan at his headquarters here in Washington. And it ended up being Leslie Groves, who was taking on the Manhattan Project intelligence wing. The others, ONI and G2, always sent their minions. And just the organization that becomes the CIA, it's very interesting to think the fact that at the very beginning, no one even wanted to interact with him at the highest levels, to give someone like Donovan, the most celebrated war hero in American history to that point, the time of day.
Yeah. First, with FDR, Donovan had a complicated relationship with FDR. He had a complicated relationship with most everybody, so that's not unusual. What is unusual is that these two guys were really political enemies from New York politics. Go back to 1932. Donovan ran for governor of New York. His goal at that point was to be president of the United States, and the New York governorship was an ideal stepping stone to the presidency. Keep in mind, Franklin Roosevelt was running for president in 1932. Donovan ran against a guy named Herbert Lehman, who had been Roosevelt's lieutenant governor. He ended up saying as many nasty things about Roosevelt as he did about Lehman. I mean, one point on the campaign trail, he accused Roosevelt of being, quote, crafty. Another time, he accused him of being a, quote, Hyde Park faker, because Roosevelt claimed he was a simple farmer from Hyde Park, and Donovan said that was a bunch of baloney. Now, in today's politics, that's pretty milquetoast, but back then it was fighting words. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt, for his part, had surrogates go after Donovan in the New York governor's race, one of whom was Eleanor Roosevelt. She hit the trail and trashed Donovan. Fast forward to 1940, going into 41, Roosevelt's preparing the nation for war. He's building up the nation's defenses. Donovan, even though he was a conservative Republican, he thought Roosevelt's New Deal was a communist plot to take over America, was part of the internationalist wing of the Republican Party. He, too, believed that the nation needed to build itself up for war and prepare its defenses. So at that point, you had two very canny politicians who saw common cause in one another. Roosevelt sent Donovan out on two diplomatic missions to Europe. First off, to assess, answer a very simple question in the summer of 1940, could Winston Churchill survive, or was Hitler going to take over England? And that was a question that Roosevelt didn't have a clear answer to at that point. Later, toward the end of 1940, going into 41, Donovan went on another mission for Roosevelt, not only to England, but also to the Balkan states, to assess the situation there for the president. Again, because you keep in mind, Roosevelt's making major foreign policy decisions at this point, not the least of which is lend-lease aid and how to get it through Congress to get it to the British. And he's making a lot of these overseas decisions largely blind to what lay ahead of him overseas. In fact, sometimes he worried so much of what he didn't know that it would make him physically ill. Mm. In July 1941, Roosevelt signs an executive order making Donovan his coordinator of information. A year later, it would be called the Office of Strategic Services. The Donovan ended up having ferocious political battles here in Washington with his bureaucratic enemies. He often said that he had fiercer fights in Washington than he did with Adolf Hitler in Europe. J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, thought Donovan's organization was the biggest collection of amateurs and misfits he'd ever seen. Well, truth be told, in the beginning, it was a collection of amateurs. The War Department, the Navy, George Marshall, the chief of staff of the Army, at first wanted no part of Donovan's organization. He thought Donovan was trying to set himself up as a czar to take over Army and Navy intelligence, which, oh, by the way, if Roosevelt had let him, that's exactly what Donovan had in mind. Marshall eventually came to accept Donovan's organization, but there were senior intelligence officers under Marshall who never did, who despised Donovan, who believed his organization was a, quote, Hydra-headed organization that was out to destroy the Republic. At one point, his senior intelligence officers set up a foreign espionage unit, behind Donovan's back. It was nicknamed the Pond. And its mission was not only to spy behind Donovan's back overseas, it collected information on Donovan, collected intelligence on his officers. They even collected information on the wives of intelligence officers. So, you know, they all played pretty hardball back then. Donovan spent a good year, almost 2 years, building up his organization in the beginning and fighting off his bureaucratic enemies so he could actually get into the fight.
I mean, it's no surprise that when FDR dies, the OSS days are numbered.
Well, it is. Harry Truman had no relationship with Donovan. And you had really bad chemistry between these two guys. On the one hand, you had a wealthy millionaire Republican Wall Street lawyer. On the other hand, you had a failed Missouri haberdasher who was a diehard Democrat. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't going to be good karma between right. these two guys. Roosevelt shut down the OSS at the end of September 1945, parceled out its functions to the Pentagon and the State Department. Now, Roosevelt wasn't deaf and dumb to the need for, you know, a foreign intelligence service, and he knew he had threats overseas, you know, with the evolving Cold War. He just didn't want Donovan or his OSS right. to be any part of it.
So let's take a look at the four different personalities that you talk about in this mm-hmm. book. Some people may think that the CIA director is a certain type. You have to be a kind of particular kind of person to be an effective CIA director. But these are all very, very different people. And their backgrounds are extraordinarily different. And, of course, the one thing that really brings them all together, other than being in the OSS and CIA, is they're all mired in controversy at one point as a CIA director. Dulles, of course, with the Bay of Pigs invasion and Iran and Guatemala long before that. Helms lied to Congress about CIA covert action. Colby is reviled by many people within the agency for releasing the family jewels. And then Casey almost brings down Ronald Reagan's presidency with Iran-Contra. We'll get back to let's take them one at a time. I think that's the easiest way to do it. Let's start with Dulles because he's the obvious one to begin with. Dulles seems to me to be very similar in many respects to Donovan, and particularly the idea of the kind of the covert action cowboy, the let's try anything, throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks, and if stuff fails, oh well, we're going to have some stuff that works and that's all that matters.
Well, it's true. Ironically, Dulles would never admit that he and Donovan were a lot alike, and that he ran the CIA basically the way he ran the OSS station in Bern. Dulles also thought he could run the OSS better than Donovan could, and Donovan knew that's what Dulles had in mind. Donovan, for his part, thought Dulles was a poor administrator, particularly as the OSS station in Bern got larger. Interestingly, Dulles's first job when he joined the OSS was to go to New York City and set up a major outpost there. New York turned out to be an ideal place to recruit foreign spies. It was full of emigres, refugees that came in, European expats, ex-royalties, a lot of them kind of shady characters who were dreaming up covert operations in their Manhattan salons for ways to destabilize German-occupied territories. Dulles and really Donovan and Dulles didn't really mind that most of these would-be emigre spies turned out to be a waste of their time. That New York was an experimental area for him to try out new things. So, for example, Dulles had his officers, when they interviewed German or European emigres, they would buy their clothes from them so that they could use those clothes for agents infiltrating into Nazi-occupied areas so they could blend in. Another unit Dulles set up was an insurance unit. Now, why would he be interested in insurance files? These are insurance records that American businesses had on Nazi Nazi-occupied companies before the war. Well, it was because those insurance records also contained very often the blueprints of the buildings being insured, which the Air Forces found very helpful in determining how they should be bombed. In November 1942, Dulles goes to Bern, Switzerland, to set up a station there. He specifically lobbied to go to Bern, Switzerland, mainly because nobody else was there. Donovan couldn't get to him, and he could run his own show. And he really did. He set up what amounted to a mini CIA in Bern, Switzerland, not only hatching espionage operations against the Germans, but funding guerrilla groups in occupied France and Italy, hatching propaganda plots, and also inundating Washington with foreign policy advice on how to deal with the Axis. Much of it was unsolicited advice, by the way.
Well, you can see a lot, if you look at his background, to understand why Dulles believed that he was at least a peer of Donovan's and not necessarily an employee. He's really a member of diplomatic royalty in the United States. His grandfather was the Secretary of State for Benjamin Harrison, John Foster. His uncle was Secretary of State for Woodrow Wilson, Robert Lansing. Of course, his brother becomes Secretary of State later on. And even he got his start at the State Department. This is really kind of what taught Dulles how to do intelligence in the first place. Can you talk a little bit about his life prior to the Second World War?
Well, it was. He was born in the 1890s with a club foot. The surgeons repaired it, but the family always treated it as a dark secret they didn't want to talk about. He was a precocious child. As you mentioned, he comes from diplomatic nobility. At the age of 8, he wrote a book on the Second Boer War. Now, it was only 31 pages long, had a lot of spelling mistakes in it, but his grandfather, the Secretary of State, had 700 copies of it published, and he got a good review in the Washington Post. So in 1916, he joined the Foreign Service and was stationed in Bern, Switzerland, with the American legation there. He became the legation's de facto intelligence officer simply because nobody else was available for the job. Learned some hard lessons along the way. Remember, Switzerland at that time was an espionage haven for the warring powers. Everyone had spies there, and they were all spying on each other and concocting all kinds of plots. One time, a man with a very thick Russian accent called the American legation in Bern, wanted to speak to an American diplomat. Dulles, who happened to be manning the phones that afternoon, was late for a tennis date. He said, call back tomorrow morning and somebody might be able to talk to you, and hung up. Found out later that the Russian who had called was Vladimir Lenin, who was heading back to Russia the next day. Dulles would tell that story to new CIA officers and recruits coming in. Never turned down a meeting, even with the most suspicious of characters.
It seems of all the people that we'll talk about here, Dulles, it's the most difficult, I believe, to call Dulles a disciple of Donovan. And many of they're almost equals. You even say in the book that Dulles's code number, and everyone had code numbers of names, was 110. Donovan's was 109. And particularly, as you mentioned, in Bern, where Dulles almost had carte blanche to do just about anything he wanted to do.
Well, he definitely, and he was, if not a disciple of Donovan, certainly of World War II, certainly of the OSS. It had a profound effect on him. In fact, he mentioned a number of times that really his time in Bern as really a lone wolf spy were the best years of his life. When Switzerland opened up and more officers poured into his station, Dulles became kind of unhappy because then he had to, deal with an administrative load, and there were a lot of other cooks in his kitchen.
Well, I mean, Dulles has a lot of events in his life, or achievements, or things he's considered infamous for, depending on what side of the aisle you're on, even or what philosophy you have, whether again it's Guatemala or Iran or Bay of Pigs. Perhaps his crowning achievement, and let me ask you about this, is an operation that he runs at the very end of war, Sunrise. Is it fair to say that this should be considered one of Dulles's claims to fame when it comes to his intelligence background?
Dulles certainly considered it one of his claims to fame. In fact, he had talked with Hollywood about writing a movie script on it afterwards. And it was an achievement, although other officers around that time questioned how much value it had. By way of background, as we're talking February 1945 going into March 1945, Dulles gets approached. He's getting a lot of peace feelers from the Germans then, from the Nazis, but they're literally lined up at his door with peace feelers. I mean, one of them came from Himmler, his representative, so wanted to see what he could cut a deal to save his skin, and Dulles wouldn't have anything to do with him. One of the peace feelers, though, came in from the senior Nazi officer, Karl Wolf, in northern Italy, who could see the war was lost. And I think he wanted to get on the side that was going to win, too, and began very secret negotiations with Dulles that were codenamed Sunrise. The British codenamed it Crosswords because Churchill thought it was a puzzle that would never be solved. And for several months, they went back and forth trying to negotiate the surrender of German forces in northern Italy. Very, very difficult process. It's difficult in any war to achieve a surrender of that large an army for a country that hadn't been willing to give up. It eventually perpetuated a political diplomatic crisis between Roosevelt and Stalin, because when Stalin's agents picked up wind of the Sunrise negotiations, it didn't take them long to find out about it, they demanded to get in on the negotiations. Eisenhower and Roosevelt and the War Department said, no, this is our front, our theater, we'll negotiate it there if anything happens. Some of the most tensest and most acrid diplomatic exchanges or exchange of letters between Stalin and Roosevelt occurred over the Sunrise talks. So they dragged on. Eventually, Dulles was able to achieve a surrender of the German forces in Italy several days before the surrender of the entire German army on May 8, 1945. At that point, Dulles saved probably thousands of lives as a result of the negotiations he concluded in Sunrise. Most of those lives were probably going to be German lives, because at that point the Allies were winning in northern Italy, and the Germans were on the defensive. So it's a good part. There's a section of the book on it because of the dance of diplomacy here, which was extremely complicated, and the whole case is debated really to this day.
Right. Let me shift focus to Bill Casey, and I understand this is chronologically out of order because Casey is the last of the DCIs from this group, but I think Casey makes a lot of sense next because he is almost the polar opposite of Dulles in many ways. Mm-hmm. As aristocratic as the Dulles family was, the Casey family was really the opposite. It's blue-collar, and as all over the place administratively and bureaucratically as Dulles was, Casey is really the administrative guru of this group. And he's a true Donovan disciple, someone who worshipped Donovan. I mean, talk in the book about the fact that he had a bronze bust of Donovan in his house. Can you talk a little bit about Casey's background? And as I was reading about him, and you can talk about this, he almost seems like a young version, or probably the same age version of Robert McNamara, kind of a number cruncher, a statistician. Am I making an improper analogy there, or is that kind of make a lot of sense to you?
No, that's the way he began. He was born in 1913, set a family record that his mother could have done without. He arrived weighing a staggering 14 pounds. He drove the nuns at Catholic school nuts because he was intent on educating himself the way he saw fit. His father was a Tammany Hall bureaucrat. At first, he thought he might want to be a social worker. Eventually, he went to Fordham University, the first in his family to go to college, then went to Catholic University of America here in Washington, became disenchanted with social work after several months as a New York social worker. He thought welfare money was being wasted, and Franklin Roosevelt was a bleeding heart liberal. Went to law school at night, got a law degree. By the time Hitler invaded Poland, he was working for a think tank called the Research Institute of America, which churned out reports for businesses advising them on how to land contracts with Roosevelt's New Deal. After the war, after the United States entered the war, Casey, who by that time was married and had a baby girl, wanted in on the action. He talked the Navy into making him a lieutenant junior grade, and he really had to talk him into it. The Navy at first wasn't impressed with this guy who didn't seem to have much military bearing to him, but they found a place for him in their in the services ship buying program. Casey soon became bored with pushing paper for the Navy. Heard about this organization Donovan had that a lot of wealthy young men were going to. Managed to wangle an interview with him. The OSS recruiters also weren't particularly impressed with Casey. He seemed to be an officer. It didn't look really like an officer. But they hired him. They discovered that Casey was a whiz at administration, and from his Research Institute of America days, could take large chunks of information and boil them down into concise, clear intelligence reports. He was packed off to the OSS's very important station in London at Grosvenor Square, basically to handle the paperwork flow there. In no time, Casey was into everything in London. He was like a human tornado. One officer there who served with him told me you could not pay attention to Bill Casey. December 1944, Donovan, who's impressed with this 31-year-old Navy lieutenant who seemed to be everywhere and doing everything, made him his chief of secret intelligence for all of Europe with the specific mission to penetrate Nazi Germany. That was a daunting mission at that point because even though the Germans were losing the war by that point, Nazi Germany was still one of the most tightly controlled police states in the world. I mean, the average German citizen had to have at least 18 basic identity documents on them, which Casey's unit, codenamed Bach, had to quickly learn how to forge. Mm-hmm. Casey managed to parachute 150 agents into Germany as the Allies advanced on Germany. And a lot of them had to operate on the fly. I mean, one of the teams, a two-man team, codenamed Chauffeur, talked to French girls at a French women at a Bavarian brothel into working with them. And so while the French women serviced their Wehrmacht clients, one of the Chauffeur agents sat in the closet with a flashlight and a pen taking notes on what the guy blurted out. He had kind of a mixed record with a lot of these agents going in. They were going in late, very, very dangerous operations. Mm-hmm. Of the 105 missions that he had, only about 57 were considered successful.
Hmm. Well, and you talk about the fact that he very quickly gained Donovan's trust, and I think you point out in the book that Donovan doesn't have the ability to move freely throughout Europe. He doesn't have the ability to be on the ground seeing what's going on, and in many ways Casey was his eyes and ears over in Europe during the war.
Well, he did. He sent Casey out all over the European theater, and he would file reports back to Donovan on it, and it really impressed him. Also sent Casey out to local bookstores in London to pick up the latest books. Casey loved books about as much as Donovan did.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's shift our focus to Richard Helms. He has a different background like the others. He a little bit more like Dulles. He's from a moneyed elite family. But both of his parents, as you mentioned in the book, are bipolar, so it had to have been a little bit of an interesting childhood growing up. Unlike some of these others, particularly Casey, but also Dulles, he was a popular guy. He was the big man on campus, kind of somebody who walked in the room and kind of took control of it. How does that help him later in his career, even pre-World War II? You talk about his career as a journalist and how that really prepares him to be an intelligence agent during the war.
Casey was the consummate spy. He had a Mona Lisa-like smile, his hair always slicked back. He was immaculately dressed. He bought his shoes for his tall, short, high-arched feet at $700 a pair from Peel & Company in London. It's interesting. You talk to folks in the CIA, they can remember all kinds of anecdotes on a lot of the other the many characters in the CIA. No one can ever remember a good story about Casey. No one can remember a good story about Helms. The consummate intelligence officer, he never left a trail behind him. He was born in 1930, shortly around the time Casey was born, but that the similarity of the two boys ended there. Helms' grandfather was a very famous international banker. His father was an Alcoa executive who had mental issues along with his mother. He was educated at one point in Europe at the Le Rosay School, a very exclusive school in Switzerland, and then at the Real Gymnasium in Freiburg, Germany. He said that really was a perfect education for a spy. He did go to Williams College, one of the little Ivies, had a Phi Beta Kappa key, and Harvard Law School open to him if he wanted it. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to go in newspaper publishing. He wanted to be a reporter. He signed on with the United Press and in 1935 was sent to Berlin, where Adolf Hitler was wildly popular. Had a very famous lunch with Hitler in 1936, September 1936, after the Nuremberg rallies, which had a sizable effect on him. When World War II broke out for the United States after Pearl Harbor, Helms was in the Navy, perfectly happy in their New York office, plotting the ship movements of merchant marine fleets so they could avoid German U-boat packs. When out of the blue, the OSS summoned him to Washington, to its headquarters. Turned out the OSS had sent a request to the Navy for an officer who spoke German and French, had lived overseas, and been a reporter. Well, an IBM computer in the Navy personnel office, and they had IBM computers back then, spit out Helms' name. Before he knew it, Helms was at a farm north of Baltimore for 2 weeks of spy training. And this is where he learned to develop a cover story, where he learned how to blackmail foreign officials for information, how to evade Gestapo agents, how to fight dirty in a bar with a a broken whiskey bottle. One of the exercises he went on, a training exercise, they gave him $18 and told him to go infiltrate into a Pittsburgh factory and steal documents on its war production. So Helms, his stomach all knotted up, his palms all sweaty, slipped into the Pittsburgh plant and absconded with documents from unattended desks and took them out past inattentive guards. They called these exercises schemes. Now, 2 weeks of spy training wasn't enough to make him a proficient spy in the field, but it was enough for an OSS staff job in Washington, where he first was with a planning unit that dreamed up operations for overseas stations, then worked with a bureau on penetrating Germany for intelligence. Also had other kind of odd jobs, too. One time, Donovan brought Charles de Gaulle's intelligence chief, who was this unsavory French colonel, to Washington for basically, or to the U.S. for a junket to butter him up. Because Helms had been a newspaper man and had and spoke French, he was assigned to the escort team for the colonel and his aides, with the very important mission of keeping the whole trip out of American newspapers. And they had a grand time for several weeks. Helms, the escort team, and the French colonel and his staff toured all over and saw the sights. They were treated to an expensive dinner at Antoine's restaurant in New Orleans. In Hollywood, movie executives arranged for call girls to entertain the Frenchmen in their rooms. And Helms managed to keep it all out of the newspapers. In January of 45, he eventually gets to London, rooms with Casey, who lived like a slob, and he starts out working overseeing the Joe handlers in the London station. They called OSS agents that they dropped into occupied territories Joes, and they assigned each one of them a handler just to make sure they got off and got, and dropped okay. And Helms oversaw that operation. Later on, he went then to war-torn Berlin after the war to set up a spy station there.
And like Dulles, he's one of the two of this group that actually continues on after the OSS into the what was called the SSU, the Strategic Services Unit, which was the remnants of the covert action side that goes to the Pentagon, and then again transitions directly into CIA. So let's look at Bill Colby now, because he is the real spy of the bunch. He's the covert action, the commando, the person that you think of as the dashing guy behind enemy lines. But his background is just as interesting as the others. You wouldn't suspect someone who parachutes into occupied France to come from the background. Now, his father was an army officer. He's an army brat himself, but a bit of an intellectual, a bit of a spit and polish guy. And Colby's background allows him to have some knowledge of the world because he's an army brat. He travels around, goes to China. Can you talk a little bit about how Colby's background prepares him for his life at OSS?
The moving from one station to another was an education in itself for him. It's interesting, though, when Colby liked to quote Napoleon's standing order to his men, which was, "March to the sound of the guns." When, after Pearl Harbor, however, Colby seemed to be marching in the opposite direction, further and further away from that sound. He wanted to get in on the action. He ended up, though, stuck at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, teaching students how to fire howitzers. Saw a notice on a bulletin board that they were looking for airborne paratroopers for airborne artillery units. And he signed up, hoping that would get him to the front. In fact, he was worried, though, that because his eyes weren't good, he wore glasses, that they wouldn't let him into the airborne artillery unit. So during his physical, while the doctor was out of the room, he memorized the eye chart. Of course, the doctor caught him, but figured that his eyes were probably good enough to see the ground when he parachuted to it. So he passed him. Bad luck, though, struck again for Colby on his second parachute jump at Fort Benning, Georgia. He broke his right ankle. By the time it healed and he finished his airborne training, Colby was stuck at a replacement pool in Camp McCall, North Carolina, again desperate to get to the sound of those guns. He saw another notice tacked to a bulletin board, this one from some strange unit he'd never heard of called the OSS, which said that if you were a paratrooper and you spoke French, and Colby spoke French, call this number and if you were looking for adventure. So he called, and within a month, he's at the Congressional Country Club outside of Washington, where the OSS had taken over to train spies and saboteurs. He becomes part of a top-secret program codenamed Jedburgh, whose mission would be to parachute three-man commando teams into occupied France shortly after D-Day. He eventually ends up training at Milton Hall in Peterborough, north of London, at a facility, a country estate there, the British set up, which was to train these teams made up mainly of American, British, and French officers. Somewhat of a culture clash between the British and the American commandos at this training, which was very rigorous. For example, the British, the Americans had to learn the British way of parachuting. The British parachuted out of planes as low as 500 feet from the ground, and their parachutes didn't come with spares.
Well, no reason to have a spare 500 feet.
At 500 feet, there wasn't any time to open it. The instructors, the British instructors, told the American students that, well, if your chute doesn't open, bring it back, and we'll give you a new one. Of course, the Americans didn't find that joke very funny. Colby parachuted into the Burgundy region southeast of Paris in August 1944, organizing French resistance factions there as Patton's Third Army approached and went through. After Patton's Third Army came through, his next assignment was leading a 32-man commando team of Norwegian Americans to drop into frigid Norway in March 1945. Extremely dangerous mission. Half his team never made it to Norway. The planes carrying them couldn't find the drop zone in the snow, or they crashed, killing everyone on board. Colby managed to, his team managed to knock out a bridge and destroy a section of railroad track on the Nordland Railroad that carried, that was taking German soldiers north to south and out of Norway to Germany, which was that was the mission of this team. But it was for him, it was exhausting work. The skiing was just absolutely grueling for him. In fact, they nicknamed one mountain they had to ski over to escape a Nazi patrol, Benzedrine Hill, because all of Colby's commandos, practically all of them, had to pop the stimulant pills for the artificial energy to get to its peak.
The Jedburgh teams and these guerrilla teams that were put into effect in Norway, it really had a lasting impact on the way people fought wars. I mean, you could really point to them as being the foundation or a nascent form of the Green Berets.
Well, exactly. In fact, after the Norway operation, Colby wrote a very thoughtful memo to his superiors about how small teams in the future should be organized to mobilize guerrilla operations in hostile countries. What he envisioned was remarkably similar to the A-teams you see in today's modern special forces.
Let me broaden this out to some broader questions, some bigger questions. The OSS, there's debates about how important the OSS was for winning the Second World War. The SOE, the British version of the OSS, had been fighting the war for years before we joined. We're really the big brother in Europe. The OSS gets a lot of rightful praise for their operations in the Pacific, perhaps more than the European theater of operations. Does it seem strange that these four future directors operated in Europe, where the OSS was perhaps the baby brother to the British versus some of the real major OSS victories in the Pacific?
Well, it's... First off, and I get asked this question by a lot of audiences, okay, what effect did the OSS have on the war? Did the OSS win the war? And the short answer is no.
The Soviets won the
war. Did the OSS shorten the war appreciably? Again, the answer is no, but that's setting the bar awfully high.
Right.
I mean, as you mentioned, there were major factors or forces at work that won the war for the Allied side. The first of which is the fact that Russian and American mothers could produce far more male babies than German and Japanese mothers ever could. Mm-hmm. Number two, the American military industrial might, the merchant marine fleet that could carry that hardware to Europe, the Army Quartermaster Corps, the Navy Supply Corps, could get all those machines and arms and ammunitions to the front, and, oh, by the way, the atomic bomb.
Right.
Now, did the OSS contribute to the war? Sure. You know, just as the soldier landing at D-Day did, the Marine in the Pacific, Rosie the Riveter in Los Angeles. Now, these four men were in the European theater, which actually was where most of Donovan's operations, mm-hmm. major operations, were. He was limited in the Pacific. Douglas MacArthur, the commander of the Southwest Pacific Forces, really wanted no part of Donovan's organization down there. He said, you know, Donovan could supply him men that would be under his command, but he couldn't work independently there. Admiral Nimitz, the commander of the Northern Pacific Forces, didn't see much need for spies and saboteurs and what he saw as largely a naval operation up there. So Donovan was confined to basically the China, India, Burma theater, which were secondary theaters. Mm-hmm. They did a lot of work there. Again, Donovan had to spend an awful lot of time fighting to get into the war in China, as it was. Our four men, of course, after the war in Europe ended, of course, Dulles and Helms remained to take over the Berlin station. Casey and Colby came back to the United States with the intention of going out to the Pacific, but the war ended, with the dropping of the atomic bombs before they could get there.
And let me wrap this up with this broader question. I kind of hinted at it at the very beginning. Is it perhaps, and you certainly can disagree with this, is it perhaps as fair to say that Helms, Casey, and Colby were as much Dulles' disciples as Donovan's disciples?
Well, they could in a way, although it was funny. There was tension, for example, between Casey and Dulles. Donovan, of course, as I say, assigned Casey as his chief of secret intelligence for all of Europe. Mm-hmm. Dulles thought Casey was too young for that job. Dulles also didn't think there was going to be much result from Casey's operation to parachute agents into Germany toward the end of the war, that there was no support structure set up there, no safe houses. A lot of them are going to get rolled up, and a lot of them did get rolled up. So those two, it was somewhat of a tension there. Colby, the dynamics with him and Dulles, I mean, he thought Dulles' Bay of Pigs operation was a fiasco and shouldn't have ever happened. Keep in mind, Colby also turned over to the Justice Department the information that led to Helms' conviction for lying to Congress over the CIA's effort to oust President Salvador Allende in Chile. Obviously, Helms never forgave Colby for that. Casey never forgave Colby for turning over the family jewels report to Congress. In fact, a friend asked Casey one time, Colby had to answer questions posed by Congress, and Casey's response was, Colby didn't have to understand the questions. So it's, between these four, it's a complicated relationship. Dulles passed Helms over for some key positions. He thought it was more useful to him in kind of a staff role, when he probably should have promoted Helms to a higher position. It may have saved him a lot of grief with the Bay of Pigs. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's what makes the story of these four and, right. and their reactions so interesting, I think.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, again, for anyone who thinks that there's a type of person that becomes CIA director, this will disabuse people of that idea. These are such different personalities.
Well, they are. Although I found a common thread through these four. They were all smart. Okay. Indeed, you could call them intellectuals because they were voracious readers. They were very curious individuals. They were creatures of reason, too. But they weren't the ivory tower types who'd sit around for hours in doubtful introspection. Mm-hmm. These were strong, decisive, supremely confident men of action. They were doers. They believed that they could shape history rather than let it control them.
Well, the book is Disciples, the World War II missions of the CIA directors who fought for Wild Bill Donovan. The author is Doug Waller. Doug, thank you for taking the time to join us here at the Spy Museum.
Good to talk to you.
Perfect.
I hope you enjoyed this author debriefing. We'd like to know if you have any questions or comments about it. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. We look forward to you joining us again for another of our author debriefings. And thanks for listening.